Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, August 20th, 2014. President Obama responds to a barbaric act. Once again interrupting his vacation on Martha's Vineyard, the president issued a statement to the press today describing himself as appalled by the videotape released yesterday by the Islamic State Sunni extremists, which shows the beheading of American journalist James Foley, a photographer. He's been in their custody for nearly 2 years. And the Sunni extremists say that they did this in retaliation to the U.S. bombing raids that have displaced from that critical dam in the area of Mosul in northern Iraq. And this is their way of fighting an asymmetrical war. And to the president's credit, at least in his initial remarks, he didn't get hot-headed. He didn't get emotional. It was no drama Obama. Compare that to the two men who challenged him for the presidency, John McCain and Mitt Romney. And if you ask what Mac or Mitt would have done in these circumstances, my fear is that they would overreact. They would take the bait. And it's very hard for a president to see an American brutally beheaded in this manner and to not want to have some emotional response. And as I've described in the last few weeks, the president is treading a very fine line. He's walking through proverbial minefields. Now we have the Syrian government finally cracking down on the Islamic State. They had kind of winked and ignored them when they were busy fighting against the other rebels arrayed against the Assad dictatorship in Syria. The British are making some noises about supporting America's military actions. And I still fear that our involvement will lead to more than the beheading of James Foley. There's another journalist, Stephen Sotloff, who is in their custody, and they flashed his picture on the screen in the beheading video that they released yesterday. And George W. Bush at least mouthed these words, which I think are sensible. You can't negotiate with terrorists. And you cannot permit them, as brutal and barbaric as this act is, to get under your skin and respond in an emotional or incoherent way. And in his comments today, Obama was appropriately critical. And he particularly went to the issue of the alleged religious faith of these Sunnis who consider themselves to be Muslim purists. And Obama, who's been accused of being a Muslim, said, "No faith teaches people to massacre innocents. No just God would stand for what they did yesterday and what they do every single day. People like this ultimately fail. They fail because the future is won by people who build and not destroy." And in a theatrical touch designed to send a message to the United States about our brutal treatment, "We haven't beheaded anybody that I know of, but we killed a couple of people, a couple of those folks, while we were torturing them." And so in setting the stage or posing their victim, James Foley, for his videotaped beheading, he was forced to read a statement that he clearly didn't write, and they outfitted him in an orange jumpsuit, just like we forced the men to wear at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And that's a signal that I think is really important, because a lot of Americans are able to completely ignore and deny not only that we still hold people, including many who've been cleared for release at Gitmo, but the message that has been sent by America's brutality. And while I'm not in any way condoning or rationalizing what these Sunni bastards did, I think it's important to understand what triggers these kinds of events. And our corporate media tends to give Americans this sense that we're the good guys. We always are the good guys. And we only tortured people because we're so good and want to protect these great Americans from evildoers. But there's a huge price that comes from our own dalliance with the dark side, as Dick Cheney put it. We paid that price yesterday, and we'll be paying it for some time to come. Now, the president has said emphatically and repeatedly that he will not put American combat troops back into Iraq. There are about 1,000 so-called advisors and scouts, I would call them, who are currently in Iraq, we're told, to protect Americans. But last week, the Pentagon issued a request for proposals. The U.S. Army's Contracting Command is looking for companies capable of deploying security assistance mentors and advisors in Iraq. Now, I don't know why they didn't just call up Blackwater, whatever they call that now, or some of the other goons that we had on our payroll in Iraq, and some of whom are still on the payroll in Afghanistan. But the proposal is a 12-month minimum contract, extendable to 36 months. And they would be assigned to the U.S. Office of Security Assistance in Iraq. This, according to Sky News from Britain. The conflict has resumed even before the most recent ceasefire expired. Israel blames Hamas, but they always do that, so I'm not always sure who to believe. And the report is that before the ceasefire expired yesterday at about 5 p.m. local time, that Israel counted nearly 150 rockets fired from Gaza. And in retaliation, Israel launched a very targeted airstrike at the home of one of the commanders of Hamas, Mohammed Deif. Three bodies were pulled from the rubble, his wife and two children, but no signs of Mr. Deif. And this is a very bloody, vengeful act. Israel has targeted Deif because he's the leader of the Qassam Brigades and has apparently been the architect of some of the rocket launch programs run by Hamas out of Gaza. Now, on July 30th, Israel's finance minister, Yair Lapid, offered these blood-curdling comments. For years, Mohammed Deif has been hiding in tunnels underneath Gaza, and that is where he will remain because he's a dead man. To Deif and his gang, I want to say clearly, just as the U.S. didn't rest until it found bin Laden and eliminated him, we will find you and bring you to justice. So the efforts to broker a lifting of the Gaza blockade and some sort of long-term agreement between Israel and the Palestinians now appears to be quite remote. And the fighting will continue, and the bloodshed and death, unfortunately, will continue to mount. We, last week, released an in-depth interview with Professor Ted Postol. It's part of my Processing Distortion series over at BoilingFrogsPost.com. Ted Postol is the MIT professor and worldwide acknowledged expert on missile defense. He told us that the Israeli Iron Dome system is largely fictional. And while Israel claims an intercept rate and effectiveness rate of 80 to 90%, Professor Postol says, it's under 5%. And it could be zero. And in that context, we mentioned that the United States Senate unanimously voted, and the House, with only 8 dissenting votes, approved a bill that had appeared out of nowhere. It was rapidly rammed through the Congress, which appropriated $225 million in funding for Iron Dome refills. And to its credit, it took Al Jazeera America to follow up and try to interview the 8 members of the House who voted against it. 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans. Let's name names. Republican Justin Amash of Michigan. Democrat Keith Ellison, the only Muslim in the House, from Minnesota. Republican Walter Jones, a man with a conscience, from North Carolina. Democrat Zoe Lofgren from San Jose, California. Kentucky Republican Tom Massey. Virginia Democrat Jim Moran. Texas Democrat Beto O'Rourke. And Republican from South Carolina, Mark Sanford. Now, what's interesting, even though these individuals, for various reasons, had the courage to vote against this bill that, of course, provides funding for a system that is fictional, and no one in Congress has bothered to ask whether Iron Dome works, they just threw more money at it. Now, when I first saw California Congresswoman Lofgren on this list, I said, great work, Zoe. She's a bright woman, and she's been a point person in attempting to find some realistic reform of NSA domestic surveillance policies. But here's a statement she issued after her negative vote. I have supported Israel's Iron Dome system in the past and do not oppose it now. But this measure didn't get even 1 minute of debate or discussion. As profoundly troubling events continue to unfold in the conflict between Israel and Hamas, it is more important than ever that Congress be deliberate and thorough in its actions. So she had the opportunity to say, Iron Dome doesn't work, Israel has committed war crimes and atrocities, and instead she talked about the process. Likewise, Texan O'Rourke gave a town hall meeting in his district in El Paso. He said, what I think what Congress and those who proposed this vote were saying is let's send a message that we support Israel. Listen, I support Israel, but I'm not willing to vote to send $225 million just as a sign of support. And I'd like our efforts and our focus to be on trying to broker a peace deal or some political solution to our problems there. And then he recited talking points from AIPAC. I believe Hamas started this war. I believe Hamas is culpable for what's happening. I believe Hamas uses human shields. And Moran, the Virginian, came the closest on MSNBC to actually criticizing Israeli actions and policies. This is just another example of the incredible grip that the state of Israel has on the Congress of the United States, and that our foreign policy, in too many respects, is devised in Tel Aviv and not in Washington. And that's why, as I reported on Monday, I'm sympathetic to the Bay Area protesters who took a symbolic stand blocking the unloading of an Israeli-flagged ship at the port of Oakland. And that occurred over this past weekend. And on Sunday, when the ship arrived, they were successful in getting longshore workers to observe their picket lines and go home without unloading the ship. So in a double cross, the company that owns the ship waited until Tuesday. They announced that the ship was going to leave Oakland without being unloaded and head for the port of Los Angeles. It sailed through the Golden Gate Bridge out into the Pacific. Then it made a U-turn, headed back to Oakland to a different dock or a different berth along the waterfront there. And the Piraeus, managed by Israel's largest shipping firm, has finally been unloaded. Afghanistan wants to unload an American journalist, Matthew Rosenberg, who writes for the New York Times, in direct reaction to an article that was published yesterday. In that report, Rosenberg said that high-ranking government officials were discussing forming an interim government as a possible resolution to the current election crisis, calls of fraud from both candidates, an action that would effectively amount to a coup. So in short order, he was called into the Attorney General's office there in Kabul. And as he was interrogated, he realized what was up. They tried to force him to sign a statement. He said he wouldn't do it without consulting a lawyer. They said he didn't need a lawyer. He hadn't been accused of anything. And then they ordered him expelled from the country. I think our exit from Afghanistan, if it actually occurs on schedule at the end of this year, is going to be a very difficult one. Every day I like to pause to thank the people who support my work through your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Steve Getz dropped by and took a 24-hour pass. Thanks, Steve. Come on back and why don't you sign up for a monthly subscription? Lauren Howard recently renewed her annual. Thanks, Lauren. Wendy Gebauer and Joey Perillo are both monthly subscribers, and I appreciate the support of each and every one of you. And I invite those who are not currently supporting me to do so. If you've got money in your bank account, I don't want your Social Security or any unemployment money. But if, you know, you've got cash flow and you can afford it, come on over. PeterBCollins.com. Under my picture, click on the link that says sign up. Choose 10, 20, $5 a month, whatever fits your budget. And you can sign up for our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Dist's Red Flag Rock and Roll CD. Well, one of the regular contributors to this podcast is independent investigative reporter Jason Leopold. And last week, good news for Leopold, he was hired as a staffer at the news website called Vice. And he's been a freelance contributor to Vice and Al Jazeera America and other outlets for the past year since he left Truth Out. And in his first story that was on the homepage of the Vice news site on Monday, Leopold reports the results of his latest Freedom of Information Act foray at our prison complex in Guantanamo. And as you know, he's provided detailed and sometimes excruciatingly painful coverage on the excruciatingly painful process of force-feeding inmates at Guantanamo who are on hunger strikes. And what Leopold has uncovered is documents that show how much of the liquid food supplement that is forced up the noses, down the throats, and into the stomachs of these men who wish to protest via hunger strike, that during the same time that the folks at Guantanamo said that there were no mass hunger strikes underway and rebranded the hunger strikes as long-term non-religious fasts, well, it turns out they ordered $300,000 worth of these liquid food supplements. The favorite is Vanilla Ensure. And I guess that information is useful, but it makes me squirm just to think about how these men are often twice a day subject to the insertion of these tubes up their noses, down their throats. This is something I personally experienced once in the hospital after a car accident, and it's one of the ugliest things ever been done to my body. These guys get it twice a day. And it just shows how the people who run Guantanamo, the folks who guard some of the folks who we tortured, are in their own reality. Oh, there are no hunger strikes, just long-term religious fasts. The alternate reality known as Ferguson, Missouri, was calm last night, despite the shooting of another black man, I can't tell if it was 5 or 12 miles away, but not too far from the scene of these protests over, 10 days now in Ferguson. And while the police got out front of the latest shooting, and their narrative appears to be holding that this was a man who robbed a convenience store, When he was confronted by the cops, he pulled out a knife. And it was described that he was holding this knife in a manner threatening to attack a cop. Two cops shot him, and they shot him dead. Now, my comments about this are, did they have to shoot him dead? Did they have no other choice? They couldn't have shot his hand with the knife in it. They couldn't have shot him in the leg. No, they used deadly force for a guy who had stolen, you know, trivial items from a convenience store. If a white man had done that, would the deadly force be used? I can only ask the question, but it deserves to be asked. And then we saw the police chief of St. Louis, in a very aggressive and arrogant way, in front of the television cameras, just kind of ignoring the ramifications of the killing of another black man, and repeating, in a very aggressive way, that his first priority is the safety of his police officers. And he didn't offer any empathy, any other thought that would show that he recognized that as a white police chief, once again, reporting the death of a black man, this time an armed black man, that might have some repercussions. And in the last 24 hours, as things have settled down a bit in Ferguson, we've learned a couple of things. One is that somewhere around 25% of the people who were arrested on Monday night are not even residents of the state of Missouri, much less the community of Ferguson or the St. Louis metropolitan area. So there are, in fact, outside people, some of whom were agitators who got arrested. And I do think that is worth noting, because when I saw some of these scenes of police counterattacks on protesters who had reportedly thrown rocks and Molotov cocktails and in some cases fired weapons, a lot of them looked like white skinhead anarchists. And to its credit, The Guardian published a story today about the uneasiness that residents of Ferguson have about these outsiders. At first they thought, oh, we're getting solidarity, we're getting support from people who don't live here. But when those people turn violent, understandably, the residents aren't very happy about it. Another factor that Ron Johnson, that state trooper captain who is nominally fronting for the white power structure and trying to pacify the black residents who have been conducting protests and in some cases gone violent. He made an important point, and I actually saw this on the video on Sunday night. And that is that media cameramen, still photographers, would be swarming around some of these troublemakers who were going from nonviolent protests to violent actions. And in some cases, I saw this, where you would see one of these young people, in the case that I saw, they were white, and they were running into the tear gas, throwing the canisters back at the cops. And they would be followed by video cameramen and still photographers. And Captain Johnson has a point that the media has a responsibility not to become part of the story, not to become a way of attracting crowds, of featuring violence in a manner that causes more of it to happen. In an in-depth interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, I had an interesting conversation with New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller. And he's an activist, a very bright man I have a great respect and regard for. And he has launched this summer a project called the Forbidden Bookshelf, ForbiddenBookshelf.com. And in it, he is presenting books that either have been buried or lost or are no longer available, very important books on critical issues. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Professor Mark Crispin Miller.
Yeah, I'm editing this series called Forbidden Bookshelf. whose purpose is to make these vitally important works that have been out of print for some time available again with new introductions. And this is something I've always wanted to do, because over the years I've been increasingly struck by how many really great books are just not out there, are unknown, have either been forgotten by the people who once read them, or are books that nobody seems to have heard of. And as I've, you know, started digging into this subject in order to come up with titles for this series, I've been really sort of flabbergasted by how many such books there are.
Mm-hmm.
There really is a vast library of books that were either killed in one way or another, or have been conveniently forgotten.
You can hear the full conversation with Professor Miller. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. I've been railing for years about the unfairness and the bizarre nature of the increased number of people who get placed on America's no-fly list. We've covered this before. There are different lists. There's a watch list, and the worst, the highest alert list is no-fly. The Obama administration, ignoring the fact that it's under a court order to do so, has said that within the next 6 months they're going to come up with a way that travelers can ask to be removed from the no-fly list. Currently, if you get on it, it's almost impossible to be removed, and they will not explain to you why you're on that list. And if you're such a threat, why don't they arrest you instead of just putting you on a watch list and curtailing your right to travel? Well, a federal judge has ruled that there is no meaningful way to challenge the designation of a no-fly list, and that is unconstitutional. And in response, the Justice Department said the U.S. will change the process during the next 6 months. Now, I have no idea why it takes so long. I think that this is something that could be implemented very quickly. And in this news story from the Associated Press about it, they profile Abe Mashal. He's from the Chicago area. And he has filed lawsuit after lawsuit, trying to understand why he's on the no-fly list and demanding that his name be removed. And he gets the runaround every time. So he filed a lawsuit, then appealed it, and the government 6 months later said, no changes or corrections are warranted at this time, with no further explanation. He appealed that in May of 2011. 9 months later, the government said its ruling was final. But then, inexplicably, after 3 years of avoiding air travel, Mashal was able to buy a ticket and actually fly last summer. And still, he doesn't know why he was put on the list or exactly at what point he was removed from it. Texas Governor Rick Perry, as required, showed up for booking in the courthouse in Austin, Texas yesterday. I've got his mugshot here in front of me, and it's nice, at least currently, to see him without those damn Clark Kent glasses on. But he has a little, not a grin, but a slight smile on his face as he poses for the mugshot. And this, of course, is in response to a lawsuit against him accusing him of abuse of power. And it's going to be ugly, because this replays a conflict that he had with the prosecutor there in Austin, a woman named Lemberg. And the Republicans who support Rick Perry have embarrassing video of her during a drunk driving arrest, depicting what I'm told is aggressive behavior towards the cops. That's the basis that Perry claims for using a veto threat to try to get her to resign. And, as you can figure out, that is the same basis on which he is accused of abusing his power as governor. Yesterday, I wasn't actually here. I pre-recorded the news and comments special report on my test drive with Obamacare. It's been 6 months now since I got covered. And I invite you to listen to that podcast. It's on the homepage at peterbcollins.com, or it might be in your stack at iTunes if you haven't gotten to it yet. And in it, I describe the monumental problems I've had, and the fundamental bait and switch. I believe they sold me a substandard product that was marketed as Platinum Insurance. They didn't disclose to me that I was a second-class citizen on a narrow network, and that my own doctor, who they had told me was in my main network, was not in network, and therefore I have to pay higher copays to see my doctor. Well, on the heels of my report on Obamacare, there's a poll conducted here in California during July by the Field Poll. They're respected. And it shows that more and more people support the Affordable Care Act, 56% across party lines and the geography of the state. And we find out that 79% of Democrats support the law, up 2 percentage points from last year. 22% of Republicans back it, but that's a 5-point increase. And 56% of voters who don't declare a party preference support Obamacare, and that's an increase of 2 points from last year. So what this tells me is that maybe I'm one of only a handful of people who's having these kinds of problems and who feels that I've been defrauded with a second-rate insurance program. But I don't think they asked that question. I think they just asked broadly, do you support the law or don't you? And to me, this is a deeply flawed law. And these poll results make it even more difficult to fix the problems that are endemic to Obamacare. And as you know, I want single payer. I want Medicare for all. That's the real fix to our health care crisis in this country. But I fear that the politics of obstruction from the right and the politics of get-along-go-along from the left will make it very difficult to find political consensus to really find a solution to our health care problems. And finally today, I want to bring your attention to a case that I only learned about over the weekend through an email that just popped into my box. In April of this year, Andrew Tomaresi, who is a sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps, who I believe was on leave and had just moved to San Diego, recovering from PTSD. And this young man, I think he's in his 20s, he hopped in his SUV in San Diego, an area that he apparently didn't know very well. And before he knew it, he was on an off-ramp sending him to the Mexican border. When he got to the border, he asked to turn around and return. He said, I don't want to go to Mexico. And he had all kinds of stuff in his truck because he was moving into an apartment. And included in the stuff in his truck were at least one, maybe two weapons. Legal weapons that he apparently holds licenses for. And the Mexican authorities took him into custody, and because he had guns, they essentially have declared him a criminal or a suspect in terrorism. He's being held in a jail, I believe in Tijuana or somewhere near there. And so if this tugs on your heartstrings, you want to get more information, there is a website, andrewfreedomfund.com. Obviously, they're trying to raise money for lawyers, but they've also been sharply critical of the Obama administration, which has not responded to a petition over at the White House website, and that at least his mother describes Obama as having abandoned her son. So take a look at that, and we'll see if we can find out more information. But just on the facts that have been presented here, he certainly deserves our support, and I think we should lobby our elected leaders and the White House to pay attention and see if they can win his release from jail in Mexico. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you are authorized to share with absolutely everyone. You got that? And go ahead, put it up on Facebook and tell me you like it. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.